This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, when you think about Duke Athletics, you think basketball. But it hasn't always been about basketball. Back in 1955, when Al Buehler came to coach the cross-country team, football was the big sport. But then, as now, coaching distance runners was not a particularly glamorous job, since those runners were not likely to become big men on campus. And, of course, they were all men and all white. Coach Buehler had a hand in changing that. Along the way, he brought six ACC championships to his cross-country teams and coached five Olympians, two of whom went on to win medals. But you talk to anybody who knows Al Buehler, and they will tell you it's not so much his ability to train athletes, but to touch lives that distinguishes this coach from all the others. He is the subject of a new book and a documentary called Starting at the Finish Line, Coach Al Buehler's Timeless Wisdom, and I am pleased to welcome Coach Buehler to the studio today. Well, good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Also with us, Amy Unell, who directed that documentary. Amy, welcome. Good to have you here as well.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So, Coach, tell us about what it was like back there, Duke Athletics in 1955, when you walk onto the campus to coach that cross-country team.
All right. Well, I was fresh out of the Air Force because I went to the University of Maryland, which was a land-grant school, taught agriculture and engineering, but at ROTC. And I was commissioned in 1953 and then served till the end of the Korean War. So I flew in here in an Air Force jet and was met by Red Lewis, who was the former cross-country coach, but also the business manager of athletics. And what's interesting about him, he spoke seven foreign languages because he was drafted in 1941 and learned to speak Japanese so he could interrogate the prisoners of war. And he got an award for that because they learned in 6 weeks.
So now some of the most famous landmarks on campus are named after people who you were coaching with, who were on the campus at the time in athletics.
Yes.
Wallace Wade is here.
Wallace Wade had just retired and become the commissioner of the Southern Conference. And Bill Murray, who had been president of his class, had coached, couldn't get a job during the Depression years, and was coaching at the children's home, which was an orphanage, and state orphanage in Winston-Salem. And his record, I think, was 83 and zip. Nobody wanted to play the orphanage.
Those kids were good.
Yeah.
So, and how did you get the job at Duke?
Well, I would have to credit, you know, Bob Chambers and Red Lewis to looking out. But they were good friends with my coach at Maryland, Jim Keough. They were all the same. And we met down in the Florida Relays. I was stationed at Moody Air Force Base at that time. So I went down during March, I think it was. And they were looking for an opening. Mr. Lewis's wife, I think, had terminal cancer. So
and you coached under Coach Keough, and you worked there. That was your first coaching
job. That was the real how I got into it, because I started out with Army ROTC, marched around with an M1 rifle on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and think I didn't want to do that. So when my junior came, when I should have taken advanced ROTC to earn my commission, Keough said, if you don't want to be a ground pounder, you better get into this. So I graduated in June 52 and got my commission in January 53. And that semester, that one semester, just like you had to make up the PE class, I had to make up a ROTC class. And he said, you're going to coach the Maryland freshmen. And we came down to Duke, and we had the first nine guys in. And
So as the coach of the freshman team, you beat Duke.
Yes, that's right.
And that got you an offer to come here and perhaps be the cross-country coach. Not a bad idea. So they raided the cupboard. Coach Keough lost a good one. You came down here and have been here ever since.
Right.
What shape was that cross-country team in? They were not doing so well when you got here, huh?
Actually, they were pretty good. But see, I've been on the Air Force team while I was in doing my other thing with radar, you see. But I was in better shape than they and probably a better runner than, so I could beat most of them. And, you know, I didn't have to, but I could, you see.
Well, and I think when the team knows that, that has an impact
on their.
And things turned around pretty quickly. You started doing pretty well.
Well, the first year we were 1 and 14, so it would have been 1-13. The only team we beat was Wake Forest, and the second year we won two. We beat Wake Forest twice, but the third year we won the whole shooting match because I had been able to recruit, and the guys that were still around were pretty good by that time.
Now, recruit, but you didn't have many scholarships
well,
to work
we didn't,
with, did you?
I still recruited. What I did, I wrote to every high school athletic association and asked me to send the results of cross country and outdoor track. And whoever had the best, I would, at that time I hired Mary Dinkins. Mary Dinkins was a sophomore at Duke and couldn't type, but she could do envelopes. So I was mailing out these letters, I used to call it penny postcard recruiting, to the, anybody that was in the top three of any event, I would write to the school.
That's great.
And many times the top teams had very good prospects. But I would say, you know, you have to have academic.
Yeah. And then you started at some point teaching a course on the history of sports.
See, that goes back to where you could get certification to be a coach if you had that was called a beginning education course, the history of education, how it worked into sports, you see.
And that turns out to be a pretty popular class.
Well,
a lot of people like that class.
Yeah.
What kind of things do you teach in the history?
Well, we start back with the Greeks and the Romans, go all the way through with all that just to show them. And I always laugh because Grant Hill was first written up in Playboy magazine when they asked him, did you take any good courses at Duke? And he said, yeah, he had one under me.
Well, and that history course. And, of course, Grant Hill is the narrator of the documentary.
Just happened that way.
And,
right.
And he talks about how important that course was and how he began to reframe his idea of
right.
sports. It wasn't just about basketball, but this was part of a very large community of people,
but
past
Frank,
and present.
The best thing about that course, Grant being in that class, was he was having his hammer toe repaired. This was happened to be a summer school class. And he said, I've been told I can't stand on my feet that long to give a 20-minute presentation, which was one of the course requirements. He said, but my father, Calvin Hill, is here, and he would be glad to come in and talk to him. So Calvin came in, and very modestly, the class all knew Calvin Hill because he was number one with the Dallas Cowboys and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, the reason Grant and I are here is because of my father. That would have been the grandfather of Grant Hill, who worked in the steel mills outside of Baltimore and Sparrows Point, where they were building Liberty boats. And he said, my dad worked for 14 hours a day during the war years. And he said, I don't want your kids to have to go through that. So I'm sending you, he was talking to Calvin, I'm going to send you to a prep school. And he went to Yale. And from there, he became a great football player. But he could have made the Olympic team if he had wanted to be a track guy.
No.
You see, he was that talented.
And his son, very talented, went on. Of course, he did great things at Duke and
right.
on in the NBA. Right. But you also, in the athletic department, coaches were also teaching what would have been the PE courses.
Oh, we all, every one of us. I mean, everybody on the football staff, basketball staff, taught something in physical education. You were an actual faculty member.
And it's interesting because you said at Duke they didn't want, there was no PE major, so the athletes couldn't really major in PE. They had to have a better academic grounding.
No, they could get a certificate in coaching a sport, see, but that's different than a whole degree, you see.
So the degree would have to be something more academic than that.
It could be an education, and that doesn't mean you're going to, you just say, I think I can be the basketball coach or track coach, whatever.
So it'd be interesting to think about that now. Imagine taking, your PE basketball class with Coach K.
Yeah.
And doing that now. How much of your time was spent in the classroom and how much of it on the field?
Well, when it was under the physical education, it was probably 50-50. I would talk about the events because in track and field, there's like 18 different events and they're entirely separate. You know, you start with the 100-yard dash, but the 200 is not much different, just twice as far.
So we talked about this, the fact that Duke is it's a men's university, a men's college, and all white at the time. And then you developed a friendship. We're going to talk more about this in a few minutes, but I want to start now and talk about Leroy Walker, who is over at North Carolina Central. And you developed a friendship with him and began to, in effect, integrate the programs.
Well, you can't put all that so quickly in there, but that is basically what happened. I came in 55, but in the spring of 56, in the winter of 56, Dave Sim appeared on he was at Duke on a baseball scholarship. People forget that. A Phillies baseball scholarship. But lo and behold, indoors and outdoors, he was setting world records in the 100 or the 60 with low hurdles, a lot of events, you know, that he just did with super speed. And Leroy Walker over, and Bob Chambers was the head track coach, but he was also the head trainer of all sports. You see, eight sports he was looking after, and especially football.
And Sims, of course, also played football.
That's right.
With none other than Sonny Jurgensen was his quarterback. You have a story to tell about that. Apparently, Sonny, well, none too quick even then, eh?
Well, Sonny was in those days, it was 3 yards in a cloud of dust. It wasn't where you first started back and threw a lot of passes. And Sonny was somewhat slow backing up to get him in throwing position. In those 5 seconds, Dave Sim was out of reach of him. He was down the field 50 yards or more.
Well, we'll talk about how Dave Sim played a role in effectively integrating the track programs as our conversation with Al Buehler and Amy Unell continues today. Al, the subject, of course, former track cross-country coach, celebrating his 58th year, because when he leaves here, Al's going back to the classroom to teach that class again for the 58th year. But before he does, we'll continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio and broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking with Coach Al Buehler. He's been at Duke 57 years. Today marks his 58th year in the classroom, goes back to teach his class on the history of sport. He's been a track and cross-country coach, a teacher as well, and we'll talk about his years with the Olympics. Amy Unell is with us. She profiled his life in her documentary, Starting at the Finish Line. So at the break, we're talking about the importance of a guy named Dave Sim, who comes on campus on a baseball school, but he's an all-around athlete. This guy can do it all, right? He's playing football. And what's his role? What happens when you and Leroy Walker get together? Because he's got a team over at North Carolina Central, not nearly as well endowed, of course, as at Duke.
Well, I would say that we have to earmark each of the people. Leroy was then the track coach. He helped out with basketball when North Carolina Central won the NAIA, the small college. So they were used to doing things, and he understood how the Olympics, the level. So they had Lee Calhoun over there and some other sprinters that were pretty good. And then Bob Chambers was the track coach at Duke, but he was involved in 56 with football and all sports as trainer, you see. But he was responsible to look after the football guys if they had an injury. And what happened was that we knew that, and the other guy at Duke was Joel Schenkel, a good hurdler. So you could have Lee Calhoun, a hurdler, working with Dave Sim and Joel Schenkel, you see. Now, Schenkel was a all-round guy. He would take part in the decathlon. He could high jump. He won the long jump in the NCAA, so he was no slouch. He might not have been as fast as Sim and as good a hurdler.
Well, I'm going to say, and forgive me for interrupting, but you've got these great athletes, as you're describing.
The three athletes was what brought us all together, because the track at Central, first of all, they didn't have enough hurdles to set up. You need 10 hurdles for each lane, and they didn't have that, and the track was in pretty tough shape. Now, we also had, you know, a cinder track at Duke at the time. It wasn't all weather. So every day our track was manicured with and lined, so we knew where the staggers were and where the hurdles went and everything like that. So we had better track and field facility at that time, so it made sense to bring the three best guys in Durham to train together under the tutelage of whoever could be there that day. You see, Bob Chambers might be on off on a football trip, Leroy might be doing his thing over at Central. He was the chairman of the department. I was teaching, no telling, badminton or track and field, you see. But somehow we would get together so we could all look at these guys, but they were on a good facility so they could run at their best, you see.
But what was happening on the rest of the campus, the rest of the team? How did they feel about it, the administration?
Well, we just went ahead and did all this. Nobody was shortchanged. My distance runners would take the Central guys out in Duke Forest and run or do the interval work we were doing around the track. Everyone benefited because they were able to run with Lee Calhoun. They would line up, say there's eight lanes, they could get in there and do the hurdles or just coming out of the blocks, you see. I mean, it was very easy to fit them all together because they all were striving to be, you know, make the Olympic team.
And the athletes themselves, and you talked about Dave Sim again. Here was a guy who, growing up, was fighting in gangs against African-American gangs.
Up there, Patterson, New Jersey, that was not... You know, that was a tough town, and the way he established himself is by being the best. See, he was with whoever played the game, he's going to be the best.
So they're here, you're integrating these two, at least in the workouts,
yes.
Right? And you traveled together
well,
as well.
That was later on, but that wasn't our first call. We would see each other at the same meets, and we'd be doing the thing, the distance runs and the field events, and he would be doing it with relays and hurdlers and sprinters, you see. But many times we would go to a Howard Johnson or something like that, and they would not wait on our families, and even though our teams were in the motel. That wasn't done in Columbia, South Carolina, you see.
Meanwhile, the athletes are really seeing the benefits of working with the very best athletes.
Yes, that's right.
In the whole area rather than just one quadrant. In the meantime, not only is it an all-white school, but it's an all-male school.
Well, they had the women's college over on East Campus, and they were the brightest and the best, those gals. When an athlete walked into a class, the first thing he counted was a number of girls because they were going to get the A's probably.
So you tell interesting stories because they had women's athletics. They played in their own league, but their recruiting was completely different.
Entirely different, you see. They went after the sports that many of the young ladies, girls, were doing in their hometown, where the country club is where you learn to play tennis and learn golf. And you went to a camp in the summertime to learn swimming or whatever it was, you see. So it just was.
So they're recruiting from country clubs, not public schools.
They would go to a public school, but, you know, their parents had to have enough money to foot the bill because there weren't scholarships to give out, you see.
Well, then along comes, now we're jumping way ahead. We're going to 1972. Title IX is enacted, and this brings equality in intercollegiate sports.
Now, Tom Butters is the athletic director. Leroy is probably the chancellor over at Central, as well as the track coach in his early years. And all of a sudden, the government says you will have Title IX, which meant equal opportunities according to the numbers of men and women. See, Carolina never had any women. See, that's why they jumped off right away. That's why Arntzen Dorrance's soccer. Mm-hmm. Mia Hamm and all those gals came there because you couldn't go. My wife had to go to the women's college in Greensboro in the 50s, you see. But they finally opened that up. And what the university's problem was, they hadn't prepared far enough advance to put money in the budgets. All they were meeting is the numbers. And because they knew if they didn't meet the thing at the end of 5 years, all the grant money in medical school or other research would be canceled.
Right. So they had 5 years to get up to speed or lose all that federal funding. There was a fair amount of resistance, wasn't there? Coaches were not, because they were worried about losing, having to share, either raise more money or share what you had.
They probably, the way we finally resolved it, Tom Butters and I got a legal pad and went out golf, swimming, whatever, we're going to pair them up and see what we had going. And we assigned from the men's sport to the women's. I didn't have a counterpart in track and field, so I ended up giving to field hockey, you see. It didn't have any. Mm-hmm. So, but.
Well, you ended up giving, you at this time were the head of non-revenue sports.
Right, see. And, so and that, I didn't feel like I could ask anybody else to give anything if I wasn't willing to do it. So that's really why Tom and I had the right approach. We're taking from the men because they have, and we're required to get this thing off the ground. Eventually, we would get money from the university, but we weren't assured of that at first.
You gave all of your scholarships. You asked everybody to give at least one, but in your case, you gave all of your scholarships.
Right, it was three, so it wasn't like I was given, like football at that time still had their 85, you see.
It's the widow's mite, if you ask me. That's 100%, and so there you go.
But see, football wasn't counted against us, I say us, the men, because there was no sport that had need of 85 in the women. They didn't have football, you see. They matched up 15 and 15 just like basketball did, you see.
Well, I'm going to ask Amy a question here because you have put together the documentary, and I'm afraid that Al's going to be a little too shy about this and a little too humble to talk about the impact that had in setting that example by giving up all of his scholarships at the moment when colleges and universities and coaches are figuring out ways around Title IX. And then Al goes ahead and does that. What was the impact?
I mean, I think the impact was really seen when you talk about Ellison Goodall, when you talk about Joni Benoit, Jackie Joyner-Kersee, Mia Hamm, and all the women today who are thankful for coaches like Coach Buehler who opened the door to equality. Ellison Goodall is in our film and in the book, and she just is pouring with gratitude for just the fact that he said, try out for the team. And she was a track team of one.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about that because I want to hear there's a moment when she talks about screwing up the courage to talk to Coach Al Buehler because there is no team for West. 1978, by the way, so we're 6 years away from the enactment of Title IX. Still no team, and here she is screwing up the courage to talk to Al about maybe being a team.
All right. Walked down the little tunnel at Wallace Wade, got to the track, and it turned around. Came back. That's happened four times. And I remember thinking to myself, you're a dumb fool. Just go meet the coach. And, you know, one of those life-changing moments.
She did. She went and met the coach. And, Coach, what did you think when she came up and made that request?
Well, I asked her to run a couple laps, and she was, you know, had been an age group swimmer, so she was fit. And just a sprite of the girl, and she ran with perfect form. All she needed to do was to get in a program and bring her along. It wasn't like I had to change anything. She was could do it.
And her father was a pretty good runner.
Yes, he was at UVA. He was and encouraged her. He encouraged her with swimming and also to, you know, ask about here. Now, it wasn't that Tom Butters was opposed to it. We just had, you know, everything going. They didn't have it in the women's college, you see, so it wasn't like they had already done it. We had club sports that were offering it, and people could. We had fun runs and all that.
But how did you get her involved in competition? I mean, if she's
well, we were able to come up with the money to send her. And we eventually got enough girls to have a cross country team. You need five or seven, at least five to score, and she was the best. But she moved right on out, and we took her to the Penn Relays and places like that. So,
well, Ellen talks in the film about how important it was to hear from you, just the encouragement that you gave her.
Well, she's being, you know, gracious and saying all that. Things were opening up around, and that just seemed to me like the natural thing to do. We had started other sports, you see. And eventually the university came along and backed him. And when President Nan came in, she was a big supporter of. She herself was an outdoors woman, you know, rode her mountain bike all around. She's named a trail after me because that was the thing that she used, you see.
So. And that trail, the Buehler Trail, which a lot of people in this area will know, it's that 3-mile or can open up at a 4-mile trail in Duke Forest. That's where you used to run your athletes.
Yeah, right? See, yeah. I live right there on the 15th. Fairway.
What about, so how much of it is about coaching the mechanics and how much of it is this other kind of more spiritual side of it or psychological, if you prefer?
Well, I mean, I think you have to gain the student's confidence when you say, go out, let's run, have go out for a 10-mile run. Steve Spurrier, I used to go with him on recruiting trips, but talking to alumni, and he says, Bueller's got the easiest job. He says, here I'm worrying about X's and O's, talking to himself and all these kind of defense and offense. And he says, I see Coach Bueller, he's got 15 guys all around him, and all he says are, you warmed up, and they all nod like that. And he says, okay.
But you did more than that.
Go.
You had sayings. You always had a saying written up on the board.
Yeah, you always say, yeah, that's right. I dare you to do these things. Anyhow, back to Spurrier, he would see these guys take off and run around, and all I would say, get set, go. Keep turning left and hurry back. He says that's all he does. He doesn't even coach. All he does is at the end of the 56 seconds, just think of they do four more of those. There's three more of those, you'll have a sub-4-minute mile. He says there's nothing to it.
Well, there's a lot to it. I'm going to skip you all around here because you were managing the 84 Olympics team. You did that in 72 and again in, was it, 88, I think. Yeah. So three times. But I'm going to take you now to 84, Carl Lewis is competing. The pressure is on Carl Lewis. Here's a guy who's expected to break all the – not only win, he's got to break all the records. He's going to break Jesse Owens' records. Pressure's enormous, and he's talking about it. And he credits you with just calming him down. And what did you say to him? What do you say to a guy like Carl Lewis?
You know, no, I would just myself, you see. I would always – first of all, it was Los Angeles. The Russians are boycotting us because we boycotted in 80 Moscow, you see. So we have a chance. The Russians aren't there. And they really, we just fired up. Reagan was the president. He came visiting the camp. And all Carl Lewis really wanted was to have a fresh uniform. And that was my job. So he wouldn't have to go there and it was smelly, used. Mm-hmm. And here's the guys doing four events, so we used a couple extra shirts. But I said, just cool it and relax and enjoy it. You're in your, you know.
Yeah, but you've got to know that everybody's trying to say things like that. And for some reason, here's a star athlete, somebody who's got way too much attention, and he probably doesn't want it all, but there he is, and something about what you did was effective.
Well, I don't know. I never made the Olympic team, you see. Some of those things were new to me, but I just know that you, from coaching the Duke guys, that you got to relax and enjoy it and keep your focus on what's doing, and you need an extra shirt, you think, here, you know, I could provide that. So,
one thing that athletes like Carl Lewis said 20 years later is that coach really cared about him. It wasn't like, win a medal because I'll benefit. It was like, I care about you, Carl. I want you to do your best.
Yeah, and Ellison Goodall said the same thing because she really had a crisis. She was in med school on the threshold. She could have been an Olympic contender, and her father died. And that was a crushing blow to her. She left med school, wife rallied to her aid.
I'm going to say, life moves on. Get on with it. You know, and same thing with...
But he also said, you know, I'm here for you. I care about you, Ellison. And, you know, he became a father figure to her and her family. So coach is very humble, as you could see, but it was beyond the sport. It was this real love and connection he had with the athletes.
Well, there's another story in there that the story of Dave Waddell. Now I'm taking you back to 72 in the Munich Olympics, where Dave Waddell's a guy who got into a little bit of trouble with his coach because he got married. Coach didn't want him to get married before the Olympics, before.
That was Bill Bowerman, who was the head Olympic coach.
The coach, yeah.
His coach at Bowling Green was a super coach, but at that time they weren't allowed in the village to work with their kids during that. And the big thing, Bowerman was opposed to him getting married just before the Olympic Games. He said, you know, naturally he had the long range. There was a guy that's 50, 60 years old saying, you know, a few weeks won't make that much difference, but your Olympic chances would.
Right. So Waddell gets married anyway, but now he's in a little bit of trouble with his coach. He's got some injury problems.
Right.
And, again, a fair amount of attention. What did you say to him? Because it what you did and the way you worked with him stays with him. He talks
well, about first of all, I was good friends with his coach. We had traveled together. My wife and I had traveled throughout the country. And in fact, her daughter came to teach down at the Duke Law School. But so when I told Dave Waddell that we would what do you want me to do? How can I help you? You say, your coach can't get in the village. And my wife probably should get as much credit because she looked after the crying bride who couldn't understand why her husband wasn't, you know, you know, there every minute to look after. So all these things would just happen natural, let's just say. Well, persistence, what I was trying to say to him, that, you know, what you've been doing, all we got to do is keep it going. I'll clock you for your splits and stuff. So this wasn't anything great. This, I would have done this for anybody that I knew that like that, to say, just, I could have done the same with the Duke guy. I had a Duke guy, Bob Wheeler was there. And we got all caught up. People forget that that's when the Palestinians went over the wall. And for 2 days, we didn't know whether we were going to have the Olympic Games right. go or not, you see. So there was a lot of unrest.
That was a terrible event. 11 Israeli athletes and coaches were killed, a West German police officer and five terrorists all killed in that. That had an enormous impact on
me. Right. That affected me just because I realized that you can do a lot of good things and all of a sudden some guys are opposed to it. And could all, just like when it was in Atlanta, the guy that put the bomb in the, right. you see. So
well, we'll
it's
talk
all
about,
very fragile.
We'll talk about the impact that had on you and your days in the 68 Olympics when you were a commentator and drove John Carlos and Tommy Smith to the airport
okay.
after they
wow.
were ejected. All that comes up in the State of Things in my conversation with Coach Al Buehler and filmmaker Amy Unell on the State of Things. The film is called Starting at the Finish Line, and our conversation will continue in a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Al Buehler's been at Duke University for 57 years. Today starts his 58th as he goes to teach his class on the history of sports. Also attended several Olympic Games. He is with me today, along with Amy Unell, who's a filmmaker and writer of the film Starting at the Finish Line and the book. And right on the dust jacket of that book, it says, Al is the best example of a teacher, coach, in intercollegiate sports. That by Mike Krzyzewski, who that's pretty tall praise from a pretty successful coach. What does that mean to be a teacher coach? I mean, I want you to talk more about that, about the difference between, because everybody in this film has said, oh, the thing about Coach Al is it's all about you. It's never about him shining because you're the star. It's they felt that, and that's the thing that propelled them.
Well, amen, I would say then. I've done it the right way, you know. Dumb as I am, you know, it just happened to be instinctive, you see.
But there's something about them. You're also working with athletes, many of whom were successful,
yes.
even if they didn't go on to be world-class athletes. They were successful at Duke and did good things. How much of that is you figuring out the limits of, you know, sort of what mm-hmm. an athlete can do and then pacing them, working them through
right.
a workout or
wow.
knowing where that envelope is? Where is yeah. the edge for yeah. them?
At Duke, you're challenged academically, so they could always put their energy in getting, if they were pre-med or pre-law, whatever they hope to be, you see it. One of the things we used to talk about is, where do you want to be in 10 years? How do you see your life progressing? So we were teaching more than just how fast you ran, and the idea was be there on a regular basis and do your best, work as hard as you could. Don't go out drinking on Saturday night if you think you're going to be a track guy. That's not going to work, you see.
Well, unless the meet is on Friday.
Well, me, so.
I'm just kidding.
You can have a beer is good. I'll tell you the story about the Olympians back in Munich, you see. They used to uncap wine and beer to get the, so they would be defizzed, but that's the best way to get calories. You see, those guys didn't want to eat all kinds of food. They just
yeah.
want to get the calories to keep training. I'm talking about Frank Shorter, who won the marathon going in 72. So
it's not Gatorade in those little jars,
no,
then?
That's not it. All Gatorade.
you were doing commentary at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico
okay.
City.
I was sent down by WTVD down there. And I would report each day by telling, like, I saw Bob Beamon jump his 29-2, which was fantastic. But I had a team that I took through Europe with 15 guys, of which 12 made the Olympic team, including John Carlos and Tommy Smith and a whole bunch of them, Bob Seger and the pole vaulter. And we never lost an event in those 6 weeks I had them. So I knew them very well. But this is also was a time where Harry Edwards from San Jose was trying to talk about boycotting the Olympic Games.
Right. There was a lot of talk about African-American athletes boycotting the Games in protest of treatment of African-Americans in this country. They decided to go. And, of course, Tommy Smith and John Carlos were gold and bronze in their event.
Right.
And they gave the black power
and Norman,
salute.
The Australian, was the guy who got second. Hmm. Carlos should have been second. America should have been one, too, but he kind of gave up when he saw Tommy Jett come off the turn and just run away from him. And Norman understood their cause because the same thing had been the way they treated the Aborigines in Australia.
It was a dramatic event, and of course, both of those athletes were immediately excoriated. I mean, right there in the stadium, people were shouting epithets, booing and hissing. All of the sports commentators were appalled, and they were thrown off the team. They felt like they didn't have a friend in the world. You drove them to the airport.
Well, because I had them for 6 weeks through Europe, and I was there at the training camp when they, you know, and when they did make the team. Carlos set a world record, but he used a pair of spikes that weren't legal at that time. Puma made a pair of spikes that had 20 pin spikes in them. He didn't do it. They just were made for him, you see. So I knew these guys, they were not doing anything really bad. The reason the boycott didn't take place is that Harry Edwards misjudged. If you don't make the team, you can't protest, you see.
I see.
A large
so you first had to make
didn't
the team.
Make the Olympic team. And those guys that did, Lee Evans didn't back. He was from San Jose. He didn't necessarily go along with what they were doing. But they did it in a way I thought was they had a reason. They felt this strong about it, and they did it with some class. I mean, they had the beads and had just one set of gloves, so one had a left and one had a right. They were not disrespectful in the national anthem. They just quietly put their hands up and say, you know, we're back home, but we don't get the same treatment. Carlos had a good idea. Why don't we all just wear just a neutral uniform and they don't worry about USA, just run and like the Greeks did, you know.
Represent who you are. Well, whatever what you said to them in that car, and I think a lot of it is what you just said now, meant an awful lot to them. Yeah. John Carlos talks about the impact of that on him today.
And I'll never forget, he was so gracious in terms of telling us about what he felt about what we did and how genuine he was in his delivery to let us know. Say, man, you know, what y'all did something that you should be proud of, because he said it was very eloquent the way you did it.
Standing up on that platform alone, Tommy Smith and I were alone.
You just made a statement that was pure and genuine, and in the long run, it's going to be received by all the people.
You know, it's interesting because it certainly was a political statement, and here is politics intruding on the purity of sport. What about that? Did you feel that in some ways it just didn't belong on this platform? Clearly not.
Well, everyone gets I talk to about how you should behave, the uniforms you should wear, so they knew that, but theirs was done because they really believed that things weren't as good as they could be. And I saw that displayed by them when they were in Europe with me, you see. So
you just got back from London and saw the Olympics there.
Saw that, and the Brits did a super job putting staging the whole thing. And look how well their team performed, the home team, you see.
How have things changed in track and field from, say, 1955 when you stepped on the Duke campus?
Well, it is so competitive, Frank. You wouldn't believe what it takes to get there, and they're getting younger and younger. And we mentioned before how the number of women entries has ballooned just because they're really – and they're talented. See? And then you have issues, I call them, like the two girls that tied for third place in the 100 meters, and they had to decide who was going to have a runoff, or would they be on the relay team?
Yeah, actually, that was – one of those is Allison Felix, who he's talking about, who – has been a wonderful champion of this story and met coach and has just really the generations that Coach has influenced and inspired is amazing. You think about just Allyson Felix, three-time Olympic medalist in 2012, to Jackie Joyner-Kersee, to Joni Benoit. It's amazing how they all relate to the words of inspiration.
And I want to ask you, as a filmmaker, how was it difficult to get these folks? They're all in the film, and they all seem very enthusiastic. Carl Lewis, Joni Benoit, as you said, Jackie Kersee, all there and very willing and seemingly enthusiastically so about the Coach.
It's amazing. I mean, each one of them was so kind and generous with their time. They wanted to talk about Coach Buehler. They remember the little details. It was amazing. I mean, Jackie Joyner remembered Coach Buehler saying to her in 84, make sure you drink enough water, make sure you stay out of the sun. And she said it was the little things that went a long way.
But also the big things. I mean, when Joan Benoit talks about just opening things up for women and how important it was that he took Allyson Goodall onto that, because they were competitors and they knew each other very well. She knew how talented Allyson was.
Yeah, Joni was at NC State running against Allyson Goodall here in the late 70s, and she remembers fondly how Coach Buehler did open the door for women in running and is grateful for those opportunities. And it was the little things and also the big things, like you said, that made a big difference. And still today, I mean, doors need to be opened, and people like Coach and Mary Decker just actually awarded Coach Buehler with a Lifetime Achievement Award at the U.S. Olympic Trials. And it was amazing to see her give Coach this award, you know, 30 years later, saying thank you for what you've done and celebrating, you know.
And it's kind of interesting in her case, because Coach, you didn't really coach Mary Decker, and yet she feels that her career was somehow changed because of Coach.
Well, she first came to Duke in Durham when she was just 14 years old at the USSR-USA meet in Durham, North Carolina, and that's when she first met Coach.
See, that's when we had 72,000 people in Wade Stadium over a two-day track meet. I mean, half of Durham was there those days, and the date was, I think it was July 7th. It was hot as Hades out there, and they're whipping up Purple Jesus or whatever they call it, you know, drink that stuff. But
well, this brings me to it again takes me back. You and Coach Walker,
right,
organized the Pan African Games.
Yes, right.
That allowed essentially a Pan African team to compete as a continental team, right, against American athletes, and this was back in the early 70s.
Yes, see, that was really where the Kenyan showed up, remember, in 56. That was their first. So we had Kip Keno there, and they just cleaned up in all the distance events. But Mary Decker was just a kid, and she couldn't believe a track meet that had, you know, the stadium. Then they all did the wave when people went by. They all stood up and did that, you see. So
it was a spectacular event athletically because,
yes,
of what it did.
Right.
It certainly got national and international attention.
Right.
But it also had, and I think and you and Coach Walker have,
right,
both talked about this, a deliberate political message. There was something about bringing people,
right,
together, especially here in the South,
oh, yeah,
in those years, that had a powerful message.
Plus, when you think that the Russians were the powerhouse, they had for the first time defeated USA in basketball.
Well, this was when you brought the Russian. That was the other event.
That was in Munich, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, two major meets held here in Durham that Walker and Buehler put together.
The first one was the Pan-African Games, and then the one with the Soviet Union.
The Soviet King Games. See, yeah. That was
another meet.
Right. That was another meet. And you talked about what was interesting about that to you was how people here in Durham, part of the reason they showed up to see these Soviet athletes. What do you think they thought they were going to see?
Well, Tara Venetian used to always say they, you know, Americans thought all the Russians were going to come with hammer and sickles, you know, because they puts his ears like that. But the truth is that we probably opened those kids' minds. I'm talking about the athletes, because we took them to Northgate Shopping Mall, and their coach tapped me on the shoulder and said, why are all those black people in there buying all this stuff, you see? They couldn't understand, because that wasn't the party line. The party line says they're out picking cotton or tobacco, you see.
So everybody learned something on that trip.
Yeah.
What about, let me ask you about college athletics today, because we, you know, when it gets in the headlines, it's not always good. It seems the competition and the money have gotten to the point where corruption is something we read about every day. Yeah. Has it got too big? Is there too much money
yes.
involved?
And unfortunately, television is what drives all that. You see, just think of how many hours NBC put on for the Olympics, you yeah. see. And everybody knows, you have talked with anybody at the Forest at Duke, and they said they watched at least something that was interesting. Yeah. And look what they did. They took a landfill and made it, that's where they're playing beach volleyball. Well, we know why some people were watching beach volleyball, you see, but Lord Coe was Sebastian Coe, the 1,500-meter guy that won in Moscow because the USA wasn't there, you see. But he's done a great job for the Brits.
So all this, and then late in your career, you become the bell ringer at Duke Chapel.
Well, yeah, just up the street here.
But you have to learn to play the bells.
Well,
you don't just push the button and it plays program three.
No. Yeah. It takes a little practice, but if you can count, you know, say one, two, three, four, and read the music, which I can do,
yeah.
you know. But it was a great thing. And Sam Hammond out of Duke Chapel, he plays them every afternoon at 5 o'clock. But they have 50 bells. We only had 10 up here, but you can play all the Cokesbury, the old, you know, gospel songs, mm-hmm. you see.
So what made you decide to do that?
Well, believe it or not, a guy in my Sunday school class, an older fella, we got into gardening, and we both had the same type of rototillers, and we started swapping tomato plants, and he said, come on up. I knew this guy from being in the same class with him, and he says, you can do this, Al. It's just a matter of practice.
So, okay. You can run a rototiller, so come on and play
with
this.
That's right. You don't need it. That's the truth.
Well, so now you're heading back to teach for the 58th year your class yeah. on history of sports. What's the first thing you tell them? Class one,
well,
day
I'm
one.
I'm going to start off with Esse Quam Videre, which is the state motto of North Carolina. Esse Quam Videre. You pronounce, I didn't know this at first, but V's in Latin are pronounced W's. Mm-hmm. See, so all right, that's the first thing I teach them. But that means to be rather than to seem to be. Don't be a phony. Don't tell me you want to learn about history of sports and then not read all the stuff or listen to what's taking place. That's why attendance counts in my class.
Well, so you put them on notice right from the start.
That's right. It's just straight there. All that stuff is what I teach. You know, I say you're going to keep a journal or a notebook, whatever you want to call it. And each day when you come in, you want to have a something sports talk issue that you want to talk about. How about Penn State? How about the Olympics? See, today we got a whole list of right. things, you see.
It sounds great. Good luck. Coach, what a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Amy, thank you as well.
Thanks so much. Our film's available on iTunes and Netflix and DVD, so hope folks can check it out and enjoy it.
Will do. Al Buehler, former track and cross-country coach at Duke. He teaches now the history of sports, still at Duke. Amy Unell, a writer and filmmaker. She made the documentary called Starting at the Finish Line. Film is currently streaming on Netflix, also available on iTunes. And thank you so much for listening to The State of Things. Our website is stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Alex Granados and Sean Wen. Haley Sklut is our intern. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas and Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.